is Saudi Arabia, which is controlled by an autocratic regime with a notorious human rights record. It never gets even a slap on the wrist for its violations of human rights inside the kingdom and its destabilizing actions in the region. Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war gets little attention on Western news channels and no criticism from the White House. Later this month, it will be the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led offensive against its southern neighbor. The U.S. is definitely a partner in this aggression. For most of the war, the U.S. military provided support, including intelligence and logistics for the Saudis and their Emirati allies. In response to the ongoing Saudi-led bombardment, the Yemenis have been learning to hit back with missile strikes and drone operations. And this is definitely angering the Saudis and their supporters, who have loudly condemned Yemeni retaliatory attacks. Such stances, especially by the United States, have drawn fierce criticism. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed the U.S. for distorting the truth about what is happening in the region. The Ansarullah's capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision are improving fast. Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution slammed the U.S. and the United Nations on Thursday for condemning the Yemenis whenever they managed to retaliate against Saudi Arabia. The Iranian leader says the UN is even acting worse than the U.S., as the world body has failed to criticize Saudi Arabia for pounding Yemen for 6 years. Ayatollah Khamenei also had tough words for the U.S. for failing to act on the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The leader said Washington is turning a blind eye to the gruesome assassination and keeps up its support for the Saudi regime and still claims to be a supporter of human rights. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is widely under fire for deciding not to punish the Saudi leadership despite the recent release of an intelligence report that shows Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the 2018 assassination. The Biden administration has concluded that directly penalizing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would risk damaging American interests. Before taking office, Biden had promised to take a very tough line on the kingdom over its human rights violations. But so far, Biden seems to have done too little to keep that promise.
Virtually nowhere has Biden done anything to change his policies. I don't think that's going to happen. The fact is that American policy making happens in the corridors of power behind the scenes, and the presidents, essentially, whether they're Democrat or Republican, do as they're told. They do as the money mafia in the background tell them, or the system, the systemic, if you like, backdrop, which is there. And Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of pointed to this, that the system, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the World Bank, whether it's the American government, whether it's, whether it's even the likes of WHO, there is an international network of, if you like, levers of power, which are used to make sure that all and sundry follow exactly what they're told to do.
Back in 2015, Iran and the P5+1 group of countries, the U.S., the U.K., France, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The deal limited Iran's atomic program that allowed the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect the country's nuclear facilities more freely. However, despite Iran being fully committed to the deal, the former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the accord back in 2018, reimposing anti-Iran sanctions that have been lifted by the deal. The new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has signaled its willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, yet it has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments under the 2015 deal. However, Tehran says that Washington must take the first step, as it walked away from the deal 2018.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
1 year after Washington's withdrawal from the deal, Tehran began scaling down its nuclear commitments. Tehran says this move is in line with the 2015 nuclear deal and a response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their commitments. A top Iranian security official has ruled out any step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He has said that Iran will resume its JCPOA commitments only if the U.S. removes its unilateral sanctions. The Iranian official said not until the sanctions are lifted will Tehran hold talks with Washington. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during a speech last month. And during his speech in February, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressures over its nuclear program.
So when the United States says now, under Joe Biden, we want to go back to the JCPOA, but Iran must do this and that, in fact, what comes after the but is irrelevant, because there should be no ifs, ands, and buts in this entire story. It is, the fact of the matter is that the United States withdrew, they reinstated sanctions, so now if the United States wants to come back to the JCPOA, they have to come back, lift all sanctions, and go back to the way the JCPOA was signed.
Israel is the most worried about a possible revival of the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the world powers. It believes that Iran is after its destruction, an accusation that Iran has rejected. After all, it has been Israel who has threatened Iran with military action time and again. For example, just days ago, Israeli jets escorted U.S. B-52 bombers in the region as a signal to Iran. B-52 bombers usually carry nuclear bombs, which makes it very ironic that the U.S. and Israel would send this signal to Iran, who is pursuing a civilian nuclear program. Last week, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, told Fox News that Tel Aviv is updating its plans for striking Iranian nuclear sites, and that Israel has identified numerous targets inside of Iran. In response to Gantz's threat, Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Amir Hatami, said that Tehran would raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel committed any mistake.
Any nation that stands in the way of global U.S. hegemony will be subjected to a massive soft war series of attacks, massive propaganda campaign that is used to justify potential military action or at least military threats. And this is something we see now regarding Iran.
Israel has also gone through great lengths to set back Iran's civilian nuclear program, including the assassination of the top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, in November 2020. The Israeli regime has constantly accused Iran of attempting to develop a nuclear arsenal. That is while Tel Aviv is the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. Reportedly, the regime has around 100 to 400 atomic warheads. Recently, it was revealed by The Guardian that even though Israel is expanding the Dimona nuclear facility, the U.S. and its European allies have not shown any concern. Again, even though Israel has threatened Iran militarily. So while the U.S. is pressuring Iran to begin talks without lifting sanctions, Iran has started enriching uranium with a third set of advanced IR-2 centrifuges at its underground plant at Natanz, amongst other advances. Iran has also threatened to stop enforcing Article 36 only if all sanctions are lifted, and it is also said that it will further reduce JCPOA commitments soon if all sanctions are not lifted.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're with you with another episode in our series. In a few episodes, we're going to make you familiar with Imam Khomeini's behavior during the period in which Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi was the source of emulation. Although Imam Khomeini was a prominent scholar himself, he highly respected Grand Ayatollah Hossein Burujerdi, as he wanted to keep the unity and solidarity of scholars and students of seminaries. Stay with us. Grand Ayatollah Hossein Burujerdi was one of the great students of Akhund Khorasani. He took the helm of leadership of Qom Seminary just a few years after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi upon the invitation of three famous scholars of Qom: Ayatollah Hujjat, Ayatollah Khansari, and Ayatollah Sadr. Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi became the source of emulation after the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani. He played a significant role in the development of the Qom Seminary, and a number of seminary students increased considerably during his management. Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi made great effort in proximity of Islamic sects and sent his representative to Egypt for membership at Dar al-Taghrib in Cairo. The famous Fatwa of Al-Azhar University's Sheikh Shaltut on recognition of Shia school of thought among Sunni sects was the result of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Burujerdi's endeavors. This great source of emulation sent preachers to different parts of Iran and abroad, set up scientific and religious centers, built mosques and madrasas in Iran and various countries, and ordered the Pahlavi regime's education ministry to add religious teachings in the course in the school curriculum for all school pupils. Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi's presence at Qom Seminary played a very important role in the prosperity of this place, and it was Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, who played a key role in bringing Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi from his hometown of Burujerd to Qom. Later Ayatollah Said Hassan Badala said on this, "When Ayatollah Burujerdi was sick and had to come to Shahrereh, just south of Tehran, to spend his recovery at hospital, Imam Khomeini visited him several times and asked him to come to Qom. The Imam said on this, "With the coming of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi to Qom, the seminary will be saved from the difference among the sources of emulation and their proponents." Imam Khomeini's younger son, late Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Ahmad Khomeini, wrote, "Among the things that the Imam considered vital for scientific life of the seminary after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi was the presence of Ayatollah Burujerdi in Qom. Thus, the Imam tried a lot for his residence in Qom, and when the late Ayatollah Burujerdi had come to Firuzabadi Hospital in Shahrereh, south of Tehran, for surgery, according to my mother, the Imam sometimes wrote 50 to 60 letters to the scholars across the country to ask Mr. Burujerdi to come to Qom. Finally, due to the effort, incessant efforts of scholars, particularly the Imam, the late Ayatollah Burujerdi was satisfied with residing in Qom." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini very much respected Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. For this reason, he used to participate in his classes, although at the time he was an outstanding scholar himself, and his classes were full of students. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Ba'izzadeh Khorasani said in this regard, "Imam Khomeini, after finishing his own class, would attend a class of great source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, along with his students. This is whilst the Imam had 400 to 500 students in his jurisprudence class." Martyr Ayatollah Fazlullah Mahallati said, "The Imam used to attend a class of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. I think this attending was not because of he needed the class, but rather because of the respect he had for Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi." Ayatollah Ali Panah Ishtihadi recounts an anecdote about Imam Khomeini's great respect and reverence towards Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. Ayatollah Ishtihadi says, "The Imam used to attend the class of Ayatollah Burujerdi and would respect him much more than a student respects his instructor. Sometimes he would accompany Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi right up to his house. Dear friends, in view of the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, besides his great scientific position, had a very firm character that reduced the oppression of the ruling system and strengthened the role of the clergy against tyranny." Ayatollah Mahallati said in this regard, "After the demise of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, we were at the Imam's service for a week in Imam Zadeh Qasem. He said, 'I insisted on Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi coming to Qom was that before his coming, there were three scholars like Ayatollah Khonsari, Ayatollah Hujjat, and Ayatollah Sadr. But there was not an eminent person to be considered as the power for the clergy. Moreover, the comprehensiveness of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi's knowledge didn't exist in others, because he had the spirit that he could rule over these rulers. Once Bakhtiar had come there, and the ulama were sitting there, too. Bakhtiar was sitting on the step whilst laying his legs. Late Ayatollah Burujerdi told him, 'Sit politely in the presence of ulama.' This spirit was not like among other ulama. And since this spirit was in the late Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, I said to him to exercise his power to form an Islamic government so that we could repress the regime or at least control it." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had decided to bring Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi to Qom many years. Late Ayatollah Sultani was quoted as saying, During the period of the leadership of Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, sometimes the Imam would ask me about Grand Ayatollah Burujadi to know what kind of a person he was. I told him he doesn't listen to government officials. He's very much independent. The Imam said happily, "Bravo, a clergy should be like this." In our next program, we shall continue this discussion. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. Good to have you from the British capital. I'm your host, Amina Taylor, and we kick things off with our top story. The British Parliament is debating the government's police crime sentencing and courts bill aimed at giving law enforcement sweeping powers to deal with protest. But the bill is facing backlash from across the political spectrum as a clampdown on freedom of expression. Saeed Poreza has this one.
The debate over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th for Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum.
The Metropolitan Police went to a very peaceful vigil, a protest about mourning the death of a murdered girl, and they reacted extremely heavy-handedly. They whipped the situation up and they made arrests. It was so unnecessary.
Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. the British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeedpur Azab, London.
There's just so much to unpick in that particular story. So much so that we brought in Richard Sedan for this one. And Richard, we're going to break this up because there are so many different elements here. Let's kick off with your first point of order on this story, please.
Yes, indeed, and good to be with you, Amina. So our first headline is talking about the rallying cry at a protest which took place last night, and that cry was "Protect women, not statues." And so we saw the second protest for Sarah Everard in recent days, and we saw quite incredible scenes by most people's understanding of the police literally surrounding a statue of Winston Churchill, and, you know, this kind of outraged protesters. And of course, in recent days, we saw the rather troubling footage emerge from a protest in the Clapham area where, you know, male police were literally physically manhandling and, you know, removing protesters who were attending a vigil for Sarah Everard. And of course, you know, Sarah Everard, it's believed, died at the hands of Wayne Cousins, who now faces charges. It's alleged he murdered her. And so public outrage really over the, you know, case of Sarah Everard. But of course, the way the police are handling it is really reaching fever pitch. And now, of course, you know, the government and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, were already pushing through this new policing bill, which Saeedpur Reza just mentioned in his package a moment ago. And of course, the scenes over the last few days, the case of Sarah Everard has really, you know, brought extra scrutiny onto this bill, which, of course, on the one hand, the pretext for it is to give the police extra strength to carry out their duties. But, you know, quite rightly, really, you know, civil liberties activists are saying this takes Britain one step closer to an authoritarian step. You know, just a cursory reading shows you that things like, for example, using a megaphone outside of Parliament and raising the noise to certain levels could in itself be an offence. So, you know, this is understandably alarming people, Amina.
It is, and this bill is being discussed. Labour, the opposition party, were going to abstain previously, but I think the optics after the weekend's protest and some of those very images that we saw of female protesters being manhandled when they're here to discuss male violence in a lot of the cases and violence against women, it just didn't look good. I think it was very difficult for Keir Starmer to do anything else other than say, vote with your conscience. And most of the Labour Party members who've spoken out about this say they will vote against this bill in its present form. They didn't really have another option here, Richard.
Exactly, and I think there might be an argument that had this bill been, you know, being pushed through at any other time, perhaps it wouldn't be facing the staunch opposition that it is now. It's become a stick to kind of beat the government with, really, by the opposition. And of course, you know, other critics might say that this bill really fits in line with some of Priti Patel's other policies, which, you know, many people are saying are draconian, particularly around issues, for example, like immigration. And so I suppose we'll see in the coming days how these details might be thrashed out and what exactly happens.
Perhaps you can get us with the online reaction there, Richard.
Sure. Let's go first to a reaction from Samantha, who says regarding the statue of Churchill, well, it's what we already know. A statue of Winston Churchill is far more important than the safety of women. And Donna Crum, on the topic of the policing bill, says, stop the crackdown on protest in Priti Patel's policing bill. Police chiefs have just shown that they can't be trusted with these powers. Write to your MP now. So strong words on social media there, Amina.
A different aspect to this has been one where people are mindful that the life of Sarah Everard had been lost, but there was a wider picture here about who gets the attention and which faces lead the narrative. Please explain.
Exactly. So let's show the headline here, because many people have picked up the case of Blessing Olusegun, who is a woman, a 21-year-old student, who went missing in Sussex in September of last year, and her body was then later found, I believe, on a beach in the Sussex area. Now, police initially said that the death was unexplained. I believe part of the investigation suggested that Blessing actually drowned. But, you know, the case of Sever Everard in the last few days has actually brought spotlight onto this case. And actually, there's a petition online which has amassed thousands and thousands of signatures, and they're actually demanding that there's a new investigation into the case of Blessing Olusegun. And actually, there's some kind of rather worrying parallels, really, between her case and Sarah Everard. For example, both women were said to be in communication with their boyfriends, you know, leading up to the time they are believed to have disappeared. And, you know, I think a lot of people are also saying that, look, there's a lot of evidence around the case of Blessing Olusegun, which certainly warrants a new investigation. And, of course, you know, the question around what might have happened to her feeds into the wider issue, really, of potential violence against women, women, you know, being, you know, being, it's not safe for them to walk around in places where they should have. And so, you know, this petition has actually gained a lot more signatures over the last few days. I think it will gain more. And actually, if you look online, Amina, tragically, sadly, there's many, many, many cases like this which are now being brought into the spotlight. And people are saying, look, something needs to be done about the climate in which these kinds of incidents can take place. And of course, you know, the backdrop is, of course, the Sarah Everard case. But, you know, within this mix, the police are certainly, you know, under scrutiny for how they're policing the process, but also perhaps even an element of, you know, the investigation itself. A lot of people are saying online.
And who takes what seriously? Let's cut through to some of those online messages, Rich.
Okay, let's go first to Vanessa, who says, Blessing Olusegun should have gotten the same coverage. To this day, no one knows what happened to her. Charlotte chimes in rather strongly with, white privilege is so important to understand in these traumatic scenarios. If you're white and hurting this week, just imagine what non-white women are experiencing. White people in the media didn't come out with this clout for Blessing Olusegun. We absolutely need to change that. Sister Space tweets, I'm so sad about Sarah's murder. I'm a black woman and a mother, yet many will disregard black victims. I didn't even know Blessing Olusegun was missing. Why? Because she's black. We need your continued support to help highlight these injustices.
Indeed. And of course, solace and solidarity with everyone who's missing someone right now, and perhaps those families who got the ultimate bad news. Richard Sedan, thank you very much. Right, we move on now, because Pope Francis has renewed his appeal to all sides in the war on Syria to demonstrate signs of goodwill. This as the conflict passes off the 10-year anniversary.
10 years ago, the bloody conflict in Syria began. It has caused one of the greatest humanitarian catastrophes of our time, an untold number of dead and wounded. I renew my heartfelt appeal to all parties to show signs of goodwill so that a glimmer of hope can be opened for the exhausted population. I also hope for a decisive and renewed commitment on the part of the international community so that the social fabric can be mended to launch reconstruction and economic recovery.
Western powers continue to sanction the Syrian population, with U.S. troops occupying the country's oil fields in the northeast. Hunger and poverty have also been used to pressure the people into submission and regime change. Now, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats have had their worst ever election result in two key regional votes. The CDU have historically enjoyed firm support in Baden-Württemberg and Rhineland-Palatinate, but early results show a marked drop, widely blamed on public anger at the response to the coronavirus pandemic, delays in the vaccine rollout, a steady rise in cases, and a continued lockdown have hit the ruling party hard. Chancellor Merkel is due to step down in September after 16 years in office. The poor election results is the first major test for Armin Laschet, who was elected party leader in January. Now, Kosovo has become the first Muslim country to open an embassy in the occupied holy city of Jerusalem al-Quds. The announcement comes after diplomatic relations were established last month between Tel Aviv and Pristina. Kosovo is the third country after the US and Guatemala to follow suit and make the controversial decision to move its embassy to the occupied area. Now, Jerusalem al-Quds remains a topic of a decades-long dispute, which started after Israel illegally annexed the region during the 1967 war. The Palestinians claim East al-Quds as the capital of their future state. Well, Mohsen Abbas, the political commentator, is with us. And your reaction to this development, Mohsen, what's in it for Kosovo?
Well, initial recognition of Kosovo since its its declaration of independence since February 2008 has been mixed, and the international community is still divided on the issue. The UN, for instance, only, I think, about 22 out of 27 European Union countries have actually accepted it. In the UN, it's 51% of the nations which have accepted Kosovo's independence, and so on. So you can see that one of the major needs of Kosovo is recognition. They need to be, acknowledged that they are a legitimate state. Israel coming on board and doing this obviously helps just in itself, but also, of course, Israel has huge influence, backdoor influence with European and other nations, which it could exert in the favor of Kosovo. So I see that as one primary benefit that the Kosovans see that they would get out of doing this. And not only have they had the recognition of Israel, they've also now gone the next stage, which is to say that they want to push their embassy into Jerusalem, only the third embassy to do it, third nation to do it, the US and Guatemala, and now, of course, Kosovo. And it is the first European country to move to Jerusalem with its embassy, and it's the first majority Muslim nation to establish the embassy in the Israeli capital as well.
Now, Mohsen, I mean, no disrespect intended to both Kosovo and Guatemala here, but not entirely heavy hitters. Do you see them opening a path to other, perhaps majority Muslim countries following suit?
Well, I think 100% Israel sees its new ties with this tiny Balkan country as part of its broader normalization with Arab and Muslim countries under agreements that were sponsored by the former US President Donald Trump. And I don't think that we're going to see Biden change that trajectory. So, yes, I'd say that it is very much, something which will help Israel to actually soften up many of the other nations that it wants to flood Jerusalem. Because, of course, flooding Jerusalem with these international embassies gives them legitimacy to, in terms of declaring it is as completely annexed, completely theirs. The Palestinians have claimed East Jerusalem, which was captured by Israel in the 67 Six-Day War, and later annexed as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Most of the international community doesn't recognize the Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem and says that competing claims the city should be resolved through negotiations. So clearly, Israel is making steps, step-by-step moves, to try and get Jerusalem annexed effectively, in my opinion.
Europe criticized this move, but there seems to be an underlining sense of tacit approval here, because if they wanted to make a song and dance about it, they could have, surely, Mohsen.
Well, the European Union did voice its regret in February at Kosovo's decision to open the embassy in Jerusalem, made it as part of a broader deal brokered, as I said, by the United States. But this is typical of the EU. They'll do these lukewarm criticisms, but actually they're going to do nothing about it. The general position of the EU is that the Palestinian state should be based on the 1967 borders with land swaps. But the fact is that that whole concept has collapsed long ago, and what we've got is a belligerent Zionist state which wants to declare this as a sort of almost a theocratic nation now. They're pushing the Jewishness card as another way of undermining Palestine, and the EU does nothing about this. The EU has really had a very toothless response to the entire problem, and it's I don't see it changing anytime soon. They defer to the Americans the lead on this. And of course, that is another benefit for the Kosovans. They want the American money, probably want aid, and by cuddling up with Israel, they'll gain on that front as well.
Mohsen Abbas, as always, thank you. To some other news now, because a prominent Dutch black anti-racism politician whose call for the decolonization of education in the Netherlands is running in the country's next general election. Sylvana Simmons, a former television personality, formed the Anti-Racism and Discrimination Party, the BIJ1, back in 2016.
Being a Western country, obviously this is a great country to live in. There are many, many things to be grateful for. However, if your reality is that of a young black person in this country, what you'll find is that from the moment you enter school, you enter the systems, there is bias and prejudice. People have lower expectations of you. People judge you differently.
Voting in the Netherlands general election begins on Monday and is expected to last until Wednesday.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Ahmed Caballo, sometimes it does beg a belief. You would not recognize that we're in a global pandemic by the reaction we're getting from some global communities on which medications could be helping the most amount of people.
Exactly, Amina. And Brazil has now taken Sputnik V vaccine from Russia, but it hesitated under pressure from Washington. And as you said, you think in a global health pandemic that we're all in this together, particularly as an outbreak in one part of the world can have detrimental effects on the whole globe. But yet, we saw pressure from Washington on Brazil in this document released by Brazil Wire, an investigative journalist called John McEnvoy. And what's startling about these revelations is it asks serious questions about Brazil's sovereignty and who Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, is really answerable to. Is he answerable to the Brazilian people? Is he answerable to the White House? Or is he answerable to big Western multinational pharmaceutical companies? Now, some are also concerned because in the documents, it also revealed that there was pressure placed on Panama not to take Cuban doctors. Now, anyone that's been following the news surrounding COVID-19 over the last year would probably argue that Cuban doctors, in many people's eyes, have been the real heroes of this tragedy. They've been going around the world. They've even been going to relatively developed nations like Italy. Yet here we have countries that really could have done with some support being pressured by Washington and pressured by the United Kingdom and British mining companies who tried to push forward the AstraZeneca vaccine ahead of Sputnik V. And now we are seeing complications with the AstraZeneca vaccine, with Germany being the latest country to say they're not going to use it because of concerns regarding blood clots. Now let's get the social media reaction to this story. So John McEnvoy, the guy that wrote this article, said 278,000 Brazilians have died from COVID-19. New documents show that the US pressured the Brazilian government not to buy the Russian vaccine, likely killing thousands of Brazilians. And another tweet says, for all the screeching about Russia using its vaccine, Sputnik V, as a soft power tool, it turns out the US has been arm-twisting governments behind the scenes not to use the Russian vaccine or accept Cuban assistance.
Now, Ahmed, could you think of a reason outside geopolitics and that whole fight for the sphere of influence that would explain why Washington would say to Brazil, one of the world's most populous nations and one of the countries that's been hit so terribly hard by this pandemic, to perhaps limit its options and limit the options for its people?
I can't think of a reason, but what seems clear to me is that while we're in this kind of new Cold War, it doesn't do the US's imperialist interest any favours if Russia is going around the world helping countries in the global south like it has with a vaccine rollout. But to scoop to this level, to put the lives of millions of people, and for Brazil to play along is really, truly alarming. And some got to ask, the UK has the worst death toll in Europe. The US has the worst death toll in the world. Maybe the UK and the US could have done with Cuban doctors and Sputnik 5, and maybe the death toll wouldn't be as high as it is today.
Wow, powerful questions there. I know what the answer from Washington and Westminster might well be, Amit Kabbala. We'll leave it there, and we will leave you there, because that's all the time we have for this broadcast. Keep it locked. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In the days leading to the 22nd of Bahman, fearlessness, hope, and the willingness existed in Tehran and in many other cities. It was Imam Khomeini who was walking ahead of everyone else. If Imam Khomeini had not been brave, if he had feared and lost hope, if he had become tired and showed laziness, that great event would not have occurred. In the last days leading to the victory of the revolution, Imam watched everything carefully and meticulously, and he was attending to all details until he rejected the martial law curfew and invited the people to pour onto the streets, and the issue was resolved. Secondly, the people showed courage and fearlessness, entered the arena and showed their presence in the true sense of the word. Whenever this diligence exists, it will be followed by divine guidance. In other words, whenever diligence and self-sacrifice exist, Allah the Exalted will not leave us alone. And those who strive in our cause, we will certainly guide them to our paths. The Holy Quran, chapter 29, verse 69.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
When his servants show diligence, Allah the Exalted bestows his guidance on them. As well as divine guidance, one will benefit from success and progress. If they had remained on the right way, we should certainly have bestowed on them rain in abundance. The Holy Quran, chapter 72, verse 16. The Arabic word ma'an ghadaqa means quenching one's thirst with fresh and abundant water. Scholars say that this phrase means resolving all the problems in life. If you show steadfastness and resistance, meaning that you will not deviate from the path, and if you take the straight path, the problems in life will surely be resolved and shortcomings will be eliminated. We should always pay attention to this point. The path that the Iranian nation has taken until today is very significant. We should be aware of its significance.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
the world with reporters.
Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to discuss the repercussions of the Takfiri organization's presence in the country. It comes as the army pushes its offensive to liberate the province of Marib from terrorist groups.
This event is to inform the Yemenis of the danger of the foreign presence and terrorist organizations, especially in the southern governorates, and it coincides with the continuing battle of Marib, which has led to mass flight of terrorists from areas previously controlled by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
The participants in the symposium said foreign forces, including those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are the main supporters of the terrorists in different parts of the country. The participants called for purging Marib from Takfiri terrorists.
Everyone knows that the terrorism in the Arab world is rooted in the Wahhabi ideology and is waged with the support of Saudi Arabia. The country is still the center of terrorism, and other countries have joined it, trying to spread these ideas among Muslims. The US and Britain are sponsoring these terrorists and exploiting them against axes of resistance to spread chaos in countries which oppose US policies in the region.
Saudi Arabia Syria has led a US-backed aggression on Yemen since the beginning of 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has also unleashed terrorists backed by Riyadh and its allies on the war-torn country. Yemenis believe that Riyadh wants to keep a hand on oil-rich provinces of their country, especially Marib. They say Saudis are advancing their agenda by backing terrorist groups with money and weapons. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
On March 13th, then-United States President Donald Trump declared the coronavirus to be a national emergency. 1 year later, many believe that the world's richest country has had the world's worst national response to the pandemic. At over a half million fatalities, the U.S. has twice as many deaths as the second hardest hit nation, Brazil. Many attribute that to the U.S. being alone among developed nations in having an almost entirely for-profit healthcare system.
It's been an extremely tough year, which is atrocious for the richest country on earth. You know, China and much of Southeast Asia have been managed to control the virus. Much poorer countries, Australia and New Zealand, which are, you know, English-speaking capitalist countries, have managed to contain the virus. So the U.S. response is, you know, from the government's really pathetic at this point.
The U.S. emulated China's example by calling for lockdowns, but they came without the governmental safety net nor the cultural solidarity which such mass quarantines seem to require. The resulting economic and personal devastation is still too enormous to be fully grasped, but the lockdowns clearly penalized the lower classes the most, caused inequality to soar, and resulted in the nation's worst economic situation since the Great Depression. The virus hit poor and non-white communities disproportionately hard, and then when the U.S. developed vaccines, these communities have been disproportionately excluded from receiving them.
A major reason for the poor U.S. response is, you know, how decentralized and dysfunctional the system is. And on the other hand, the lack of, you know, a militant, independent working class movement to really fight and demand those things that people in other countries are getting. If we had that sort of militant working class organization, we could have made those demands. The ruling class, the capitalists, would have probably conceded more.
The pandemic came amid, or maybe contributed to, major social protests towards racist policing, a bitterly disputed presidential election, and the hardening of unprecedented social divisions over the past year. The United States has pinned its recovery not on making structural changes, but on the vaccines that they have been able to produce. Should the vaccines fail to prevent a third major corona wave this spring, the resulting socioeconomic and cultural disaster would reach uncharted territory. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Miss Farrell, Jadino. These words sound meaningless to ordinary people, but to every thalassemia patient, they're lifesavers. In fact, they're the drugs that chronically transfused patients use to remove excess iron from their bodies. Otherwise, they would die. According to experts at this conference in Tehran, Iran needs to import 17 million doses of these two drugs annually to supply thalassemia patients. But only 2 million doses make their way into the country. The problem is U.S. sanctions. According to Iran's Thalassemia Society, since the U.S. reimposed sanctions against Iran in 2018, 187 thalassemia patients have lost their lives simply because the bans denied them access to life-saving medicine.
Since the U.S. reinstated the anti-Iran sanctions, 7,000 of them have lost their access to necessary medicine, and many of them have died.
Thalassemia patients are not the only victims of U.S. sanctions. People with EB, which is a severe skin condition, are also faced with drug shortage. Hadi is among the 800 EB patients in Iran, to whom sanction is an unending nightmare.
One in every 50,000 people contracts EB, which is known as a barfly disease, so it's a rare condition, and so is its medicine in Iran. We're constantly on the lookout for the drugs to arrive, or else painful blisters will develop on our skin.
U.S. sanctions do not directly